Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson. Greetings and welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Tapson. Back in September, you may recall if you listened faithfully to this podcast, and if you do listen faithfully, you're obviously brilliant, interesting, and good-looking. I was joined by historian James Hankins, formerly of Harvard, to talk about his recent book, The Golden Thread, A History of the Western Tradition, Volume 1, the first part of a magnificent two-volume work spanning the entire sweep of the greatest civilization in human history. That's right, I said it, the greatest civilization in history. Changed my mind. I also wrote a review of it, the first volume anyway, for frontpagemag.com. Now, as you know, if you listen to this podcast and or follow my Substack page, the motto of which is Make Western Civilization Great Again, preserving Western civilization is a professional concern and a humble mission of mine, and the same goes for Professor Hankins and his writing partner in this project, renowned historian Alan C. Gelzo. It's hard to find a Western history textbook in modern times that does not, to a greater or lesser extent, reflect the subversive perspective of woke educators, whose mission is to deconstruct, dismantle, and destroy Western civilization. This textbook, and I don't even like to use the word textbook, which for many people suggests that it's dry, boring, and scholarly in an off-putting way, this two-volume work intentionally rejects that left-wing propaganda and reclaims a properly balanced view that does not whitewash the history of the West, but does celebrate its triumphs and its role as an overall force for good in human history. It's an incredibly beautiful and invaluable resource for teaching your children or grandchildren or yourself about the highlights and lowlights, the glories and the travesties of Western civilization in a way that you won't get from public schools, or even most private schools. I have the author of the second volume of The Golden Thread about the modern era with us today to talk about it, and I think you're going to love this conversation. So stay tuned, and don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you don't already, so you don't miss any of the compelling conversations we are having here. Don't touch that dial. My guest today at the intersection of politics and culture is a best-selling author, a prominent historian, and leading Abraham Lincoln scholar, having won the prestigious Lincoln Prize a record 3 times. He serves as the Thomas W. Smith Distinguished Research Scholar at Princeton, and is the author of, among many other books, The Golden Thread, A History of the Western Tradition, Volume 2, which we're going to talk about today. Alan Gelzo, welcome to the Right Take Podcast.
Excellent. Thank you, Mark.
Professor, let me first congratulate you, as I did your writing partner, James Hankins, whom I had on a previous episode a few months ago, on this gorgeous book. As a homeschooling father of 5, this 2-volume textbook is something that I will most definitely use for their history education and could even see myself handing down to my kids for their children. I asked Professor Hankins a similar question, but want to get your take on it also. What distinguishes this work from other histories of the West?
Well, for one thing, it is broader in its scope in terms of topics. This is not simply a political narrative. It is not simply what the King of England did to the King of France, who in turn did something nasty to the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, who in turn was miserably handled by the Pope in Rome, who in turn had his argument with the King, blah, 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 like that. Well, I shouldn't really make political history sound like blah. But possibly there are histories out there of politics that are quite blah, and frequently they are in the form of textbooks. So even though many textbooks will make some token gestures in the direction of subjects other than politics, overwhelmingly they're really talking about political events.
Yes.
These books are different. These books are really a history of ideas. Mm-hmm. And politics, of course, has a role to play in them because politics itself is composed of and motivated by ideas. Yes. But these are fundamentally histories of the progress of ideas, the progress of culture, of this thing that Hankins and I call the Western tradition, and the civilizations which make up that Western tradition.
You begin the book with a quote from the 17th century Puritan minister Richard Baxter, who says, quote, "Posterity is wronged by a misinforming history. The prodigious lies which have been published in this age and matters of fact doth call men to take heed what history they believe," unquote. Boy, if only Baxter were alive today to see what prodigious lies are now being promulgated about history by critical theory educators and popular conspiracy theorists, such as the notion that Churchill was the real villain of World War II and Hitler was just misunderstood. Is this a consequence of an increasing historical ignorance in the West, and how do we reverse that?
Well, part of it is definitely ignorance. Ideas of this sort can't be sold except in a vacuum of information, when
yes.
people have little or nothing to compare them with. The promoters of conspiracy history are generally Johnny One Notes, who have gotten on a particular plank that they are going to ride to fame and glory. And they ride it very quite expertly in many cases, if you grant the premises of the plank they're riding on. It's those premises which are usually wrong. Not only wrong in detail, but often wrong in the whole concept, because when you're dealing with the Johnnies, the Johnny One Notes, what you're dealing with are people who have seized on one explanation that explains everything. And generally, when you have an explanation that explains everything, you have an explanation that explains nothing. One thing that good history always keeps in view is the multiplicity of human experience, that people are not always motivated by the one same thing. The one same thing does not explain it all. There are different ways of doing things and highly conflicted ways, culturally, intellectually, and you have to take honest account of those things and not simply pick out one and say, this is the vehicle that everybody rode in. No, history is less like a lonely journey in a jalopy or a Model T down a country road that hasn't even been paved yet. That's the conspiracy mentality. Rather, human history is more like a multi-lane freeway in which many vehicles are proceeding at different speeds, sometimes wisely, sometimes recklessly, sometimes with one goal in mind, sometimes with a very different goal in mind. And history wants to understand the multiplicity. It wants to understand how many different lanes there are in that freeway of ideas and cultures. Because that is how we understand the full complexity of human events. And in a sense, that reflects the complexity of human nature. One of the principal problems I have with conspiracy theory history is that it not only has a simplistic notion of events, it also has a very simplistic notion of human nature. And it seems to me that good history, healthy history, realistic history is as much cognizant of the complexity of human nature as it is of the complexity of human events and human society. So what Hankins and I are looking to do in the Western tradition is to give some honest reckoning of this multiplicity, what the result of it has been, and then to see how it has moved in some directions and how it has moved in some others. I like to pose to Jim this conundrum. He has the advantage, having written the bulk of Volume 1, he has the advantage of talking about this Western tradition in terms of its ascent upwards.
Yes.
Starting with the Greeks, starting with the Battle of Marathon, literally, and then moving up through the civilization of Rome, through the Middle Ages, the civilization of Christendom. I take over from him at the year 1500.
Yes.
There's a sense in which I get to go down the other side and chronicle the problems which have plagued the Western tradition and Western civilization ever since 1500. So he has the joy of rolling the stone to the top of the mountain. I have the dubious pleasure of riding it down the other side and hoping that we're going at some point to take a curve back upwards.
I was actually going to make exactly that point, that he basically chronicled the rise of the West up to its peak in some ways, but you had a less enviable task of covering some pretty catastrophic periods. Professor Hankins opened his Volume 1 with the Battle of Marathon, as you noted, a battle that he says determined the whole later history of the West. You begin Volume 2 with Martin Luther legendarily kicking off the Protestant Reformation. Why begin modern history there?
Because it is a great rupture in one of the great institutions, culturally, intellectually, even politically.
Yes.
In the Western tradition, which is the Christian Church. The Christian Church had experienced rupture before. There had been schismatic movements, and of course, there was the great break between Western Christianity and Eastern Christianity, between Byzantium and Rome. But what is happening in 1517 and the years following is in its own way fully as dramatic as the break between Byzantium and Rome, and perhaps even more important given the worldwide impact that flows from the great break of 1517. That is a break heard around the world.
Yes.
And continues to be heard around the world, and which we still have not after more than four centuries, we have still not come to anything that even looks like a resolution of it.
Well, there's so much to cover in this book. I'm just going to jump ahead chronologically a few centuries to talk about a specialty of yours. I'm a big believer in the great man theory of history, and Abraham Lincoln certainly qualifies and is a figure I personally admire. In fact, I have a couple of great books you've written about him. We've seen protests in recent years in which busts and statues of Lincoln and many other American icons have been defaced or torn down. But what did Lincoln do for this country that those protesters refused to acknowledge? And how did he come to embody American democratic liberalism, as you put it in the book?
I think the people who have decided to take Lincoln as a target of a program, and in this case, a monument destruction and defacing, are first of all people who have a very shallow understanding of what Lincoln accomplished and the odds that were against him. I think they also suffer from what we might call a certain yearning for celebrity. If you tear down a statue, let's face it, if you tear down a statue of Grover Cleveland, no one's going to notice that. That's not going to be on the news. Who cares about Grover Cleveland? Well, some people obviously do, but their numbers are few and their influence small. Mm-hmm. If you want to make the evening news, and of course these people thrive on that kind of publicity.
Yes.
Take Lincoln as your target. That'll get you the attention of the people in the media. So you go after Lincoln because the dividends that are paid for it are much greater than if you decided to have a demonstration against James Knox Polk. So I'm sure there were demonstrations about Polk in his day in the 1840s, but the urgency has long since dissipated. Lincoln is different. Lincoln stays with us.
Yes.
Now, why does he stay with us? I think that's the other part of the question you're asking.
Yes, sir.
Lincoln stays with us because in so many ways he captures what the American experiment aspired to from the very beginning. Hmm. For one thing, he's an example of mobility. What the American experiment was about fundamentally was about the overturning of hierarchy. The notion that human society is a hierarchy of classes or levels or stages, and that everyone is born into a particular level of that hierarchy. And that's where, for the most part, you stay. You're a king because you're born of a royal family. You are nobility because you're born of a noble family. You're a commoner because you're born of a common family. And odds are, if within that common family of common families, you're born the offspring of a butcher, you will pretty likely be a butcher, as will your offspring after you, with some exceptions here and there. That's where the general flow of things is going to be. It's hierarchy. That sounds to our ears today stagnant. But it only sounds that way because we have lived in a very different environment. If we were to pick things up, as quite literally I do at the very beginning of Volume 2 of The Golden Thread, if you pick up life in the year 1500, what that kind of hierarchy guaranteed was security. Otherwise, people were terrified. It would be a world set adrift.
Yes.
But the American Revolution, coming as it does as one of the great moments of the 18th century Enlightenment, points to hierarchy and says, hierarchy in political and social life has no more validity than hierarchy did in understanding the physical universe when we talked about a great chain of being. Galileo and Newton put that one to rest. All right, now, following on Galileo and Newton and the physical world, Locke, Montesquieu, and the other political thinkers of the 18th century, including Thomas Jefferson, have put the notion of political and social hierarchy to rest. Now, government is a product of the consent of the governed, not handed down from heaven as a hierarchy. Lincoln is an embodiment of this. He's born in rural poverty. His rise to any kind of success is full of so much mobility and self-transformation that in almost any other country on the face of the earth in his lifetime would have been unthinkable, would have been impossible. But in the United States, it's different because there is no nobility, because there is no hierarchy, because people are free to make of themselves what they are able to do. So yes, right away, just the very fact of his life, that here's someone who was born on the frontier, or at least the frontier as it was in 1809, who then becomes president of the United States and a world-celebrated figure. This is unprecedented. This is unthinkable 150 years before that. But now, here, it is. And not only it is, but it's becoming routine in American life. So Lincoln is a tremendous marker of that abolition of hierarchy. He's a tremendous marker that says to us that the American Revolution was right. That if you get rid of hierarchy, the kind of people you will get as leaders will include a Lincoln. That's yes, the possibility. So Lincoln stands out for us in that way. Lincoln stands out for us in a second way, because Lincoln was the president during the moment, the greatest moment of American crisis, which is the Civil War years. And his leadership in guiding us through the maelstrom of the Civil War and coming out at the end of it, one nation again, that is an achievement of amazing magnitude. And when you compare it to the experience of civil wars in other places, there was, in fact, a tremendous civil war going on at the same time as the American Civil War in China, the Taiping Rebellion. Its result was much, much more
unpleasant. Yes.
Lincoln guides us through that. And not only guides us through it, but he provides a moral framework in which it is to be fought, and that is the ending of human slavery.
Yes.
That is an extraordinary achievement simply on its own. So you take those two things, and to the third you add this, the man's own personality. There are certain kinds of, let's call them personality traits, that seem to be appropriate to different forms of governing. In monarchy, for instance, what you want to celebrate is honor. You want to celebrate triumph, vindication, conquest. That's what makes a famous king a famous king. And the proof is in the Shakespearean pudding. Simply look at the way Shakespeare talks about kings of England.
Yes.
We don't remember, for instance, kings like, let's say, William the IV. Zero. How about George the IV? I mean, there's another one. Oh, my goodness. But what do we remember in terms of great English kings? We're remembering those who were great conquerors, or sometimes great losers like Charles the I. Mm-hmm. We remember them. That's what typifies monarchy. Bureaucratic leadership also has its own characteristics. Bureaucratic leadership is about efficiency. It's about expertise. It's about regulation. Democratic leadership is different from these others. Democratic leadership has to be typified by qualities like resilience. the ability to absorb punishment. Hmm. Lincoln certainly had that. There has to be some humility.
Yes.
Not understanding that you were somehow anointed to do whatever you decide you want to do, but you're responsible to other people in making that decision. And in addition to resilience and humility, a certain sense of humor, of understanding that you don't take yourself too seriously, but humor that also acts as an antidote to failure and depression. Knowledge. Lincoln is a very intelligent, knowledgeable figure. We often think of him, because people then sometimes were tempted to think of him this way, as the lawyer jokester. Huh. That is a tremendous mistake in understanding Lincoln. For him, he understood not only the intricacies of law and knew how to make them work, but he understood the intricacies of government. Now, sometimes it was a learning process for him. When he's elected president, he's never been in an executive position before in his life. He's never been the governor of Illinois. He's never been mayor of his hometown. He fails twice in trying to get himself elected to the Senate. So when he's elected president, it's, as he once put it, he was accidentally elected because the opposing party had split into three factions that dissipated the strength of their vote. But he learned, and he learned very quickly. He had a mastery of his subject. All of these things are tokens of what we think of in terms of leadership in a democracy. And where you find that leadership, you find some extraordinary accomplishments. Lincoln and the Civil War is one, but in The Golden Thread, I moved to translate this into some other environments. One of them, for instance, is post-World War II Germany. There, post-World War II Germany had what post-World War I Germany never got, and that was an extraordinary example of democratic leadership in Konrad Adenauer. And today, we do not think very much about Konrad Adenauer.
Yeah.
We don't talk terribly much, but his leadership of Germany in the post-war periods was extraordinary. Extraordinary because, like Lincoln, he had that resilience. He had the humility. He had the humor. Well, probably less of it than Lincoln, but still, he had that. But above all, he had the knowledge. Knowledge of himself, knowledge of his people, knowledge of what Germany had gone through. And that is a major reason why Germany after World War II does not repeat the follies that ensued at the close of World War I. So Adenauer is an example in a different environment that way. I would even point in that respect to Charles de Gaulle. Charles de Gaulle also, while he could be singularly lacking in the humor department, and people were critical of him for not really being much of an example in terms of humility. Nevertheless, the man's command of the situation in the post-war decades in France was really remarkable. It would be difficult to think of France or Germany or Europe as a whole today without the post-World War II democratic leadership of Charles de Gaulle and of Konrad Adenauer. So I add them to Lincoln, why we should have monuments to people like this, why we should study them, and why the people who want to throw paint and refuse on their memorials are barking up a dangerously bad tree.
Speaking of Europe, you have a chapter called A Withdrawing Roar, which I recognize as referring to poet Matthew Arnold's famous observation about the Christian faith retreating from Europe like a receding wave, a continent that had once been known as Christendom. How did that retreat or decline help pave the way for what you call, in another chapter title, the century of trial?
Because it removed or began the removal of a central core of reference for all Westerners. And that was the basics of the Christian faith. Yes, there were distinctions within that, Protestant, Catholic. And I think we can even extend that. I think we should extend that to include the Orthodox, whether Russian or Greek, the Eastern Church. What the 19th century succeeds in doing as a century of romantic rebellion is removing that joined sense of reason and faith that had guided the Western tradition through centuries, through almost two millennia. And that is disputed in the 19th century. But in repudiating that, there was nothing to put in its place, which is why Arnold will go on to say, after he's talking about this long withdrawing roar, he wants to say, ah, love, let us be true to one another. Why? Because we haven't anything else. And that is a confession of desperation. I know that Arnold was trying to make it sound noble, but it is really a confession of desperation. And it's a confession that becomes increasingly shared by Western intellectuals through the balance of the 19th century and into the 20th century.
You conclude the book with a section called The Clash of Civilizations. In Samuel Huntington's famous phrase, we're still engaged in that clash. Do you think that clash of civilizations is shaping up to be perhaps the greatest challenge that the West has ever faced?
Mark, I'm not a pundit. I don't know. It reminds me of the comment that's supposedly been attributed to Zhou Enlai when he was asked, you know, what did he think the ultimate result of the French Revolution was? His response was, it's too early to tell. And I think there's a real sense in which
good point.
The clash of civilizations itself is going to be a very difficult thing to predict. We did not anticipate this. We thought through most of the 20th century that whatever clash there was, it was going to be a clash about political and economic theory. And it was going to be a clash between the heirs of Marx in the 19th century and the heirs of the Enlightenment from the 18th century. That's what we thought it was going to be. And then suddenly, in 1989 to 1991, all of that falls to pieces, and falls to pieces so suddenly that we almost could not believe we were looking at it. That's why Francis Fukuyama poses that question, is this the end of history?
Yes.
But Samuel Huntington, who had been Fukuyama's mentor, so to speak, Samuel Huntington said, no, we haven't been looking at the right ball in play here. Much more long-term, much more important is going to be this clash of civilizations. And Huntington, of course, is the first, or at least the most obvious articulator of that. Now, we are a number of years on from Huntington's clash of civilizations.
Mm-hmm.
Enough years that it has become clear that not everything that even Huntington predicted would be the future has turned out the way it has. One example is that Huntington certainly missed the significance of the Russia-Ukraine war. I mean, he said, oh, it's going to be impossible that people, two nations that have come from the womb of orthodoxy, will go to war with each other. That would be a contradiction of the clash of civilizations. Well, it happened, yes. So there are some problems even in Huntington. So if Huntington can't tell you exactly and accurately what is going to happen as a result of a clash of civilizations, I'm certainly not going to make myself out to be better or wiser than Huntington. I will answer, I am a history person. I can talk to you about the past, and I hope intelligently, in such a way that helps you to understand the present. Can I project from that into the future? I go back to the freeway analogy. There are too many lanes with too many cars going at so many different speeds. It would be a rash thinker, indeed, who would suggest that they could accurately predict that way. If that could be accurately predicted, then we did not have to have the aftermath of Marathon. We did not have to have the fall of Rome. We didn't have to have anything, because those would all have been anticipated on the basis of previous events. We can't do that. I know there are people who believe that they can, and sometimes... Yes. Sometimes they're accurate on certain points. But even Huntington's mistakes are a warning to me. Stay within yourself. Don't overreach. So that's why Volume 2 actually ends with 1991 and what we could call the leading edge of the clash of civilizations. Is that going to turn out to be the most important long-term trend? I don't know.
I couldn't help thinking that because you did end the book when you did in 1991 or thereabouts, that you were leaving room for perhaps a third volume or an addendum of some sort, a follow-up to the two volumes that you two have put together so far. Is that just hopeful thinking on my part?
No, that's hopeful thinking on my part. There is room, so to speak, to take the narrative itself and push it beyond 1991. But I think that we have to let some time go by so that the judgments that would be made are based on something fairly close to real experience. When that addendum is likely to be added, even that I can't predict. We might wait 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years. Mm-hmm. Maybe someone else will end up having to bear the burden and carry it forward. I don't know. But yes, you do guess correctly in that a window, at least, and perhaps a rather large door, has been left ajar at the end of a volume two for a subsequent edition to take things further to the ever-receding present.
So I suppose the message of these two volumes is essentially that we can't even move forward into the future if we abandon the legacy of the past. Is that fair to say?
Cicero had it right, I think, when he said that anyone who is unfamiliar with their history is condemned to live as a perpetual child.
Yes.
And there are many trends at work today. Much as I hate to use the word trend, it sounds like a little animal that runs around causing things. There are many forces, there are many movements at work today which would like to erase history for a variety of reasons, and especially the history of Western civilization. I think the long term of that cripples us. It cripples us to live in the present, and it cripples us about facing the future. It actually is an effort not so much to talk about the past, but to influence what the future is going to be. I remember that the literary figure, Milan Kundera, once said about dictators are always telling you about the future. But in fact, they really don't care about the future because nobody can really see what it is. What dictators want to do is to get control of the past. Because what control you have of the past is going to become an engine that will take you into the future. Maybe not in the directions or with the results you're thinking, but that's why dictators and tyrants and aristocrats are, as Kundera said, always going to be much more interested in getting control of the past. Don't be fooled by them. They're making promises about the future, but they're really no better in espying what the future is going to be than anybody else. What they want to do is control the past.
Apart from everything you've said so far, in the process of putting together this epic volume, is there a particular event you wrote about or a movement or a singular figure that you found especially compelling or powerful or meaningful somehow, a kind of a highlight in the book that you might like to share?
Johann Sebastian Bach.
Oh, really?
One of the things about these two volumes that I think set them apart from what you had referred to earlier as the run-of-the-mill textbook is how broadly Jim Hankins and I have tried to cast our net.
Yes.
So that these are books chock-a-block full of art, discussions of art.
Yes.
Discussions of music, discussions of philosophy. I devote an entire subchapter to J.S. Bach. And I do that for two reasons. One is that Bach is great stuff, simply. I'm trying to remember who said this, but it certainly is on the mark. That when you listen to Beethoven, what you learn about is Beethoven. When you listen to Mozart, what you learn about is how to be human. When you listen to Bach, you learn about the universe. And I think this is true. So I devote a subchapter that way to J.S. Bach for that reason. Second reason is that Bach is so closely linked to important movements in the 18th century within the Enlightenment itself. So I move in one direction about Bach to say that Bach flies far, far above. Bach is at 30,000 feet. He's giving a view of the whole planet, the whole system, the whole universe. But at the same time, he's also speaking to issues that are pertinent to his own time in the Enlightenment. So I really wanted to do what I think I had never seen in any other textbook, narrative, general overview narrative. And that is just simply stop and spend some time talking about Bach.
Hmm.
That is probably the most difficult thing to do in a narrative like this, because words will carry forward the discussion of politics or philosophy. Images will carry forward the discovery of movements in art, because you can reproduce paintings, you can reproduce murals, and so on like that. It's much more difficult to use words or images to talk about music. And in a book, I'm sorry, there's no button that you can push and have something of Bach played for you. You've got to use words to do it. That's a challenge. But at the same time, I think that explains why so few volumes of this sort actually take on, not just Bach, but music as a whole. Because it is difficult to translate into simple words. All right, I'm going to have a go at it. Yes. And I'm going to have a go at it. And you and your readers can make a judgment as to whether it's successful. I'm going to have a go at it because I think it's worth doing. And in fact, we do it not only for Bach. We do it for a number of other significant musical figures. Verdi, for one, who stands really as a key figure in the modern development of what we call music. Vivaldi also gets some space to himself. And later on, towards the end of Volume 2, I talk about Wagner, Tchaikovsky, and Brahms, who represent three very different ways of going at the creation of Western music. So that aspect of things, Bach and music, the role that they have in, especially in Volume 2 of The Golden Thread, I think that is probably one of the more unique aspects of these books.
Professor, what can the average student or citizen do to preserve the Western tradition? Is there something that each of us can do to come to its defense?
Yes, you first of all can read The Golden Thread.
Yes.
In a way, that is why we wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
We wrote it because there is a need today to reintroduce people in the West. I'm using the term West in a very broad sense. Mm-hmm. To reintroduce people in the West to their own past. It's like being introduced to a family that you might have forgotten about, that you suffered some amnesia or some strange disease of the consciousness, and now you have to be reintroduced to your family. Or maybe you were an orphan who grew up in an orphanage or grew up in a foster home, and only now do you discover that you actually have relatives, and you're going to meet them. You're going to be surprised by them. Sometimes you're going to be put off by their behavior. Other times you're going to realize that there are things about yourself that you didn't realize had a tie to another point. But now you're meeting the people with those other points, and you realize you are tied to them. You're not a surprise to yourself. You might even say it's like someone who's discovering who their birth parents were. And then when you do that, you realize, sheesh, now I understand something about myself. And now I understand why I respond in certain ways. Or, in a negative sense, why I'm prey to certain illnesses. That explains things to you, and you need to know that. So what these books are like is a way of making people reacquainted with their own lineage, with their own intellectual genealogy. That's the place to begin with this. Now, move out from there. What are you going to do with this? You're going to pick up threads of the great accomplishments of the Western tradition, and you're going to understand that these are things that are worth explaining to others and worth defending when they come under attack and assault. A government, for instance, by law, not by whim, not by impulse, not by passion, not by decree, a government by law, that is one of the great signal heritages of the West. Have we always understood that perfectly? Certainly not. any more than any child growing up in a household perfectly understands the rules that are laid down by their parents. Afterwards, as adults, they realize, oh, that was a good rule. Now I understand. All right, well, likewise with government by law, and this is just one example among many. Government by law is a thing worth defending because it keeps human behavior in certain channels that cannot be disrupted simply by the will and by the whim of powerful people. It understands that there is more to human life than simply the it explains to you that power is like some of those items on the chemical chart. Elements that are very powerful, but also very toxic. Polonium. It only takes a very small amount of polonium to poison a human system. The use of power is like that. You need some element of the exercise of power in order to have a government by law. But you do that keeping power within very sharp restraints. Because what you want to do is you want to give primacy to government by law. If you take power purely by itself and turn it loose, which is what many people today think politics ought to be, the acquisition of power, beating someone else over the head with power, feeding on power as though it was some kind of meal, politically speaking, doing that will not give you civilization. It will give you barbarism.
Yes.
Because power is what is typified by the behavior of barbaric societies. Barbaric societies that, by the way, may dress up in coats and ties.
Yes.
You know, barbarians are not just people who wear skins and live in caves. Get that simplistic notion out of your head. There are barbarians who are in top hats and who fly around the world in very expensive jets. They are barbarians because they worship power. And they think that power is the only factor to be reckoned with in human society and in human life. And they're wrong. And Western civilization is a testimony against that.
Well, there's so much more to talk about with this book. We've only dipped our toes into a few places of it today. It's just an amazing and enlightening resource. Professor, are you working on something new now? And how can people also best keep up with what you are doing?
Well, the story of what created the Golden Thread is a curious one in its own right. Hankins is more easily identified as someone who is likely to write a book like this. He is a great historian, probably our greatest living historian, of the Italian Renaissance. And being a man of the Renaissance, maybe it doesn't entirely surprise us that he would write a book that would involve the Renaissance, that would involve Christendom, that would involve Rome and Greece. I'm an Americanist. I do American history. And so people might look at me and say, well, where did he get picked up for this project? He doesn't even do European history. Well, bear in mind that these books really did not come into being just overnight. They didn't come into being, in fact, over a series of overnights. In a sense, Hankins and I, who have known each other for more than 50 years, believe it or not, Mark, we went to high school together. We were in some of the same classes, we were in some of the same this, some of the same that. We were in all the music organizations together. So we have been going at these questions for five decades and some change. So in a way, we have been writing these things. We've been writing these two books for a long time. We have been pursuing these questions over all these years. So even if our specialties are Renaissance Italy in the 15th century, or America in the 19th century, we have spread our rug and our varieties of rugs over large floors over the years. And these have been issues that we've talked about constantly and copiously. So, in that respect, these books really are the product of a long genesis and come from our curiosity about questions that are out there beyond our specialty. So if I'm writing about the 18th century Enlightenment, Yes, that is a bit different from 19th century America, I'll be the first to admit. But it's a subject I've been interested in for a very long time.
Yes.
Have done, I would imagine, more than the usual kind of reading that other specialists devote to things outside their specialty. I know that sounds like I'm patting myself on the back. I'm afraid that my problem is, and it's a problem I share with Jim Hankins, we're just curious.
Yes.
We want to keep finding out things. And so we go plowing into areas way, way outside the boundaries of what we're usually identified with, because we're just confounded curious. And especially if we can find greatness and excellence in so many different places.
Yes.
So I will find it in a Vivaldi. I will find it in a Bach. I will find it in a Pascal. I will also find it in Baal Shem Tov. I will find it wherever I can find it. And I'm just curious about it, and so is Jim. And that's what produces these two books.
Alan Gelzo, once again, thanks for the monumental effort that you put into this book, The Golden Thread, and thanks so much for coming to The Right Take. Please keep up the great work.
All right. Thank you, Mark, and enjoy the reading of them.
Yes. Listeners, I would say to any homeschooling parent out there, or any parent who cares about their child's or grandchild's education, get this amazing work of history, the two-volume The Golden Thread. It's an investment in your children's growth as patriotic, informed citizens, and God knows we need more of those. And thank you for tuning in, as always. Don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you haven't already. And if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Be seeing you.